There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news? I'm brought to you live.
It's Just Past 5 on Tuesday, April 9th, and you're listening to CKUT broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at CKUT.ca. I'm Jules Bigel, and I'm going to be guiding you through the next half hour of stories that I've been working on here at the station with the support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Starting off with the most exciting event on anybody's to-do list this week, the eclipse that happened yesterday. I went to Jean Moss Park and McGill campus to talk to some of the many thousands of people who stopped in the middle of their workday to take a look at a truly profound celestial phenomenon. Later, you're going to be hearing about the closure of a beloved children's bookstore in the Mile End and the ongoing TA strike at McGill University. We've got all that coming up in the next half hour. Take a listen. Yesterday, Montrealers took time out of their days for a once-in-a-century experience, a total eclipse of the sun. Over the course of about an hour, the moon obscured part of the sun until completely blocking it for about a minute and a half, in which the city went dark. CKUT was on McGill campus in a nearby Parc Jean Mons, chatting with some of the thousands of people who gathered to watch.
It's the shadow of the moon is basically on the earth, somewhere on the earth, that happens to be going through Montreal. And so basically it happens every few years somewhere in the world. It's just this particular eclipse is traveling through a highly populated area of America and Canada. And so that's why it's getting a lot of excitement around it.
This is Michael Smith, who flew with his family all the way from their home in Los Angeles to see the eclipse in totality. He says they were slated to go to Austin, but made a last-minute change because of the weather, ending up right here in Montreal.
It's a great, great environment. Everybody's friendly, and my kids are excited. My wife's excited. I'm excited, too.
Smith was set up on McGill's lower field with his wife, two kids, and camping chairs, plus a 2-foot-long telescope attached to a digital camera.
Yeah, so during the pandemic, I got into astrophotography, something I could do for my house. So basically, you take a camera lens or a telescope and put a camera on the back of it. And if you have a special mount that can basically compensate for the rotation of the Earth, then you can take long exposures. This is astrophotography. Instead of taking pictures of stars, we're taking a picture of our star, the sun, right?
I mean, yeah, obviously, like, the moon moving in front of the sun, that's, like, basic knowledge. But also, apparently, it's going to be, like, the sunset, but, like, all around you when it's, like, totality.
There were thousands of others on McGill campus alone, among them a group of second-year students. They might not have had the same setup as Michael Smith, but a little reading and a few pairs of eclipse glasses was all they needed to enjoy the afternoon.
I literally got the glasses today as well, but yeah, that's kind of all I know. I'll just experience it.
So I've been excited for this for like 2 months. So I bought mine on Amazon for like $5 2 months ago. But I think the prices have definitely gone up a lot. I bought it for like $5, but yeah, it was like a month and a half ago.
That was smart. You planned ahead.
I was excited. I was excited for this.
Where did you?
Sketchy ones though. And she had to trade them for mine.
We don't talk about that, you know? I still bought them. I was prepared. I didn't know it was going to be sketchy, but that's besides the point.
You were giving them out for free here on campus.
No, I didn't know.
Yeah, you know, like, there was so much hype about it, too. You know, like, are we going to get glasses? Or not? I found my glasses on the floor of the metro. Stars aligned. Stars aligned. There was no more glasses at the libraries anymore. They went like, ch-ch-ch.
Melody and her friends were set up in Jean Moss Park, playing Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. Although it was a warm, sunny day, they were beside a mound of snow that had yet to melt and were using it to keep their drinks cool.
They were like, oh, we don't have a cooler, it's gonna be hot. And then we come here and there's this like pile of snow. It's amazing, it's just amazing.
So how many, you have what, maybe like a dozen beers, some cokes?
They store their meats, like there's a group, like they've been like, see, you see the sausages? Like, yeah, like it's been, there's another one there.
There were thousands of people in the park, some alone, but most in groups of family and friends. One big group nearby said it was the first time since September they'd been able to get together for a park barbecue.
Our good friend Jack, he's from New Zealand, and in New Zealand there's this really amazing cultural phenomenon that they partake in called the sizzle, where friends get together on the beach, in the field, in a park, and they sizzle sausages, hot dogs, and it's a great community thing. A lot of friends are here. Honestly, I don't know a lot of the people here, but the sizzle is what is bringing us all together.
Across the park, we spoke to CKUT's Sophie Marisol, who's in a group celebrating the eclipse's supernatural energies in their own way.
So right now we're between two tarps on the ground, but we have a charging station because it's good to charge some magical objects under the eclipse. We got some magical lottery cards down. We got some altar contributions, some lip balms. People have put down tarot cards, and you're supposed to like charge. You can charge drinks, so we have some wine down. My friend whose mom's passed away, that's her driver's license. We got some candles. We got some pickled eggs, some binoculars. We're like stacked.
But the question on everybody's mind was, how's the eclipse going to feel? And how will everyone respond?
I'm really curious to see how the crowd treats it. I know we have a lot of friends who are kind of chasing the eclipse and trying to be in as a perfect place as possible where there's no like light pollution or anything. They're going off island. Some are going to Verdun because they just can't get all the way off the island with a car, but I, one, kind of wanted to skip the traffic, and two, I feel like we're lucky enough to be right here in the exact spot that we need to be, and I feel like the more that I have to travel, like, the effort will diminish my return on what I experience here. And no, I'm excited to see what the energy is like with the whole crowd, and, you know, hearing if there's going to be a hush or a scream or something amongst everybody.
Here's what happened when totality hit. Just a warning, this next part contains some swearing. But that wasn't the end to the celebrations. Just a minute later, as the sun started coming out again, Laurent Chouinard proposed to girlfriend Zeynep Bertzak. And guess what? She said yes.
I didn't want to like compete with the sun and the moon for attention, so as soon as the totality was done, I popped a question. And it was a good, great success, I think.
Yeah, perfect moment, yeah. I would say. I'm just so happy, you know, like, it's such a beautiful day and such a special moment just happened. I will never forget this.
Just one more reason to celebrate Montreal's first total eclipse since 1932. I'm Jules Bujal. Thanks for listening.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.
A beloved children's bookstore has just closed its doors. April 8th was the final day for La Petite Drawing Quarterly, which has been in the Mile End for the past 6 years.
Maybe 8 years ago, I remember hearing Peggy talk about maybe, possibly, this wild idea of creating a separate children's bookstore.
This is Mitali Banerjee-Ruths, a mother of three who's been a customer at Drawn & Quarterly's flagship store since moving to Montreal around 15 years ago. Over the years, she's developed a relationship with the store's owners, who one day came to her with the news. They were opening a children's bookstore right across the street.
I remember feeling so excited, this fizzy joy, because at the time, my kids were little. I was rereading kids' classics and discovering new titles, and also nurturing dreams about becoming a children's book author myself. And then 6 years ago, La Petite Drawn and Quarterly opened its doors to the community, and my kids loved it. I loved it.
But within a couple of years, the pandemic hit, and manager Kennedy Rook says sales never recovered.
We all love the La Petite very much, but it's been a real struggle over the past few years to keep it open with the declining sales. I think the pandemic was the catalyst. We definitely never really saw the sales pick up to the point they were before the pandemic. And of course, people do have less money to spend, less disposable income to spend on things like books. And I think that, of course, contributes to it too, especially in like the recent, you know, months and past year. But yeah, we really never saw the sales get back to where they were before the pandemic started.
The news has hit longtime customers hard. Rani Cruz, a mother of three living in nearby Outremont, says that her kids have been going regularly since the store opened.
It's sort of their safe space, I think, that they've had since they were little. And because they got to know us really well, once in a while we get an email saying, hey, I think Talisa would really like this book. It's about dragons, or, you know, Solène. This book is just, you know, about learning how to read, and it's also about dragons. We were big on dragons. So they, you know, they would keep an eye on books that we would like. And then often during COVID, we would just order them via the phone, and then they would just bring them that day.
I almost wish there could have been some, like, save D&Q, like they didn't put out an announcement.
Speaking now is Ariel Aronson, a translator and mother of two. She says that even though many of La Petite's titles will still be available at the flagship store, it just won't be the same experience.
The overall experience of walking into a children's bookstore is, to me, like, really unparalleled. And I felt so lucky to be able to have that for so long. And I think, you know, maybe like possibly some of the rest of the neighborhood, I guess I took it for granted.
Aronson has another connection to the store through her work. She says that made it special as well.
They would stock my translations. And it was, it felt like coming full circle. Like, I'm not saying that my translations were, you know, smash bang. They weren't bestsellers. They weren't, you know, they weren't going to make or break anybody. But it felt nice to be able to say, like, I'm a local client, but I'm also, like, a local artist.
It's the same story for Mitali Ruths. When she became a children's author, it was the folks at La Petite Drawn and Quarterly who hosted book launches and helped get the word out, even when in-person events weren't possible.
In 2021, still amidst the pandemic, when large events weren't possible, the owners and booksellers did something so beautiful. They made a large window display with my first picture book, Archie Celebrates Diwali. And it was, as a first-time author, to feel that local support, to feel famous in my neighborhood, meant the world to me. And by going to other events, other book events there at La Petite, again, I met many amazing writers, readers, and creative people connected through La Petite D&Q. And here in Montreal, we're quite lucky to have some incredible, talented, generous children's book writers and illustrators and story makers. And it's been my privilege to meet them all through the store.
If La Petite was a hub for local talent, that was felt by the kids who went there too. The store hosts a weekly drawing club, each one hosted by a local comic artist. Cruz says that the drawing club, as well as the pre-pandemic book club, were the kind of events that made La Petite different.
So my middle kid was very, very into that club. They would have a comic book illustrator, graphic art illustrator, who would come, and he or she would sort of kind of be there for, like, oh, we could do a project, or, you know, why don't you guys start drawing, and, you know, I'll take a look and give you some tips, kind of thing. I just don't think you get that anywhere.
Oftentimes it's a kid asking you, like, how would you draw an airplane? Or sometimes it's collaborative, where a kid will be like, here's my page, can you draw a bowl of soup on it? And then I'll draw the person eating it. So yeah, it's just a really great way to engage with kids and to be there and to do art.
This is Gabrielle Drolet, a freelance writer and cartoonist who works with The New Yorker and The Globe and Mail. She's also a volunteer host of La Petite's Drawing Club.
A lot of the kids have been coming for a few years, and so they go to different schools. They're not from the same part of the Mile End or of Montreal, but they know each other through this drawing club. And also a lot of the kids are new and they're really young, right? It's a big variety of age and drawing experience and interest. I think it's really important. You know, when I was a kid, I spent a lot of time at my public library, and I really cherished having spaces that weren't directly connected to group or to school, rather, that were arts based, that I could hang out in. And I think any loss of that is a huge loss for the community.
Drolet says she hopes the club will continue, even if the space changes. The plan for the storefront on Bernard is to transform it into an events-only space for Drawing Quarterly. It already was a space where they hosted book launches and other events, even for graphic novels and other adult works. That future may include children's events as well, but manager Kennedy Rook says the team is still figuring that out. But no matter what happens, they're thankful for the support La Petite has had over the years.
I'm so grateful to everyone in the community for their support. And yeah, I do think it's like a real gift to have been able to have the space, to have La Petite, even, you know, if it can't be forever. There's not a lot of children's bookstores in the world, and I think that's really special, and I'm glad we did have it for the years that we did.
I'm Jules Bouchel. Thanks for listening.
Les Productions 8 d'Afrique presents Malian superstar Oumu Sangaré, who has influenced the likes of Beyoncé and Alicia Keys. Oumu Sangaré will perform an exclusive concert at M. Tillus on April 21st, 2024. Tickets and info at festivalnuitdafrique.com.
You're listening to CKUT, broadcast on 90.3 FM in Montreal and online worldwide at ckut.ca. I'm Jules Bigel. Just a disclaimer for this story, which is about the TA strike that's ongoing at McGill. As a former McGill grad student, I have TA'd for McGill in the past, and because of that, I tried to get more of a comment from McGill than what you'll end up hearing in the piece, but was denied. McGill's administration and legal team have an open offer to come and speak on CKUT about this issue. Now, here's the story. It's final season for undergrads, but at McGill, it's looking a little different this year. As of Monday, the school's 1,600 teaching assistants are on strike, and they're making their voices heard.
When I say union, you say power! Union!
Now, in their first week of an 8-week strike mandate, TAs are pushing for a number of provisions to make life more affordable, starting with a pay increase. Here's bargaining committee member Dallas Jokic with the details.
So our sort of key demands have been an increase in wages to make us competitive with other top schools in Canada. At schools like U of T or Queen's or McMaster, TAs are making $45 to $50 an hour. We make $33.03 at McGill. We're also fighting for healthcare funds to supplement gaps within the health insurance that graduate students have through PGSS. And we're fighting for indexing TA hours to undergraduate enrollment. So basically, in a lot of departments, we're seeing class sizes are staying the same number of students are enrolled, but we're getting less and less TA hours. In psychology, they just cut all the contracts from 180 hours to 150 hours, which is both, you know, a position for overwork of TAs, and it's a declining quality of education for students. And so from McGill, we've really been seeing little movement. Their offers have remained extremely low on wages, and they have, for the most part, refused to consider anything on indexing TA hours to undergraduate enrollment or on healthcare fund.
Jokic says that with last year's high inflation, McGill's monetary offers would be an effective pay cut, According to the union, the latest offer would see a 4.25% salary increase in the first year, with 2.25% in the second year and 2% in the third and fourth years of the contract. The going rate is around $33 an hour for TA pay, about $13 below the average for Ontario's top research universities. Mobilization Officer Emma McKay says that if McGill wants the reputation of their neighboring schools, they should be willing to pay for it.
The average TA wage at seven other universities that McGill loves to compare itself to, like U of T, York, UOttawa, Carleton, McMaster, Queen's, and Western, is $46.36 an hour. Actually, it's just increased a little bit because U of T had a strike vote and successfully increased their wage significantly without even having to go on strike. So U of T was much more ready to negotiate. So we don't think it's fair that we make such a little hourly wage compared to these universities where we do the same work at the same quality. And McGill benefits so much off of its reputation, comparing itself to these other universities. And they should pay us in accordance with their reputation.
You might say that it makes sense that McGill TAs are paid less than at schools like U of T. McGill profs are paid less too, and Montreal is just a cheaper place to live. But the pay difference persists, even taking into account cost of living. According to 2022 StatsCan data, cities like Ottawa and Toronto are 10 to 20% more expensive than Montreal, based off the income threshold that a family needs to live. But TAs at schools like Carleton and Ottawa are making around 40% more, and it's over 50% more at U of T. McGill's grad students say it's an unfair difference, and it's affecting their ability to get by.
What we've been pushing for is not necessarily we need to get the identical wage of U of T, but we want some kind of plan to catch us up with other top schools in Canada. McGill is like considers itself one of the top schools in the country, one of the top schools in the world, the Harvard of the North, when they are recruiting new students and doing public-facing things. But when it comes to paying its TAs, they don't want to hear any of it. $33.03 an hour might sound okay, but in the context of graduate student work, where those wages are meant to in many ways subsidize the research that we do, in many, many departments, students are having to make tough decisions like skipping meals, not affording groceries, having to move because they can no longer afford their rent. And so within the context of grad student life, the wages are just one piece of the picture of people really, really struggling to get by.
This is all in the context of the Quebec government's out-of-province tuition hikes, which McGill says will cause them to lose tens of millions of dollars per year starting next fall. They've responded with a hiring freeze and cross-campus cuts. Not exactly an easy time to push for a pay raise. But TA say the money is there. It's just not going to student workers.
We just heard last week, or a couple weeks ago, at this like funding town hall from McGill, that you know it was time to tighten the belt, that we're going to have to do some austerity. And yet they also told us that administrator salaries will not be affected. For some comparison, administrators, like all 40 or so of the administrators at McGill, make about $12 million combined. All 2,000 TAs at McGill make about $12 million combined.
The U of T president makes about $450,000 a year. The McGill president makes about $490,000 a year. So the president makes more money. And the TAs make over $14 less per hour.
Defining, you're no good. Defining, you're no good.
The strike has put McGill professors in a difficult position. In an FAQ section on their website, McGill HR says profs are expected to step in and do TA work, though not maybe over the same timeline or to the same extent. A 1981 policy has surfaced as well, which says professors can be put on unpaid leave if they refuse to comply. The TA union, meanwhile, says that this counts as scabbing, which is illegal under Quebec labor law, and comes with a fine of up to $1,000 a day. They say that under current jurisprudence, replacement workers can't perform the same tasks that striking workers did if they didn't do them before. And that since profs choose which tasks will be done by TAs through a start of term contract, that jurisprudence applies to this situation as well. Here's Barry Eidlin, an associate professor of sociology at McGill and labor expert, about that debate and how the university has responded over time.
The position's been evolving. So they initially were saying that the work done by our TAs consists of part of our quote-unquote normal faculty duties, and that we are responsible for all the evaluation involved with all of our courses and our course design and all the instruction. And then we just happen to have these helpful TAs that sort of do this stuff for us normally, but in the event that they are not available for whatever reason, it's still our responsibility to cover all this work. In this recent FAQ that they have come out with, they have sort of, they initially were saying that academics are not managers. Now they are saying that we do count as managers because we have authority over how to direct the work of our TAs. We have, we can assign them certain tasks and we can supervise them in different ways. And so the hiring, firing thing is just one criteria of many, and we satisfy all these other criteria, and therefore, as managers, we are entitled and indeed ordered to do the work of normally done by TAs in the event of a strike. Basically, what McGill is doing is that they are sort of asserting this is the case when the case law is actually far from settled on the matter.
These discussions are going to affect how and how much grading happens this term. CKUT has reached out to McGill for more details about all of that and everything else in the piece, but they've responded with only the following message. Quote, McGill is not commenting on details of the labor dispute with teaching assistants, aside from noting that the university deeply values their contributions and recognizes their right to labor action within the parameters of the law. McGill looks forward to continuing discussions with the union for the renewal of the collective agreement. The university is continuing its operations, prioritizing the measures necessary to ensure that students are not unduly affected by the labor action. But what about the students? Well, CQUT was on campus to chat with a few of them, who say that this final season is a little more uncertain than usual.
I have a couple research papers that we need to get TA approval on for, like, within the next few weeks. And so, yeah, I came at a really bad time for that, especially. So, like, I have a few profs that are probably going to be getting just, like, thousands of emails being like, can you approve my topic? Can you approve my topic? So, yeah, right before finals, like, definitely, like, could be using some emails and stuff with the TA, but obviously, you know, that's not an option, so the profs will just kind of have to pick up the slack.
But most students CKUT spoke with expressed support for their teaching assistants, and the hope that they and McGill could come to an agreement that was beneficial for TAs.
There are some TAs that I see more often than I do my profs. Like, mm-hmm. They're doing a lot of work, especially in, like, these huge lectures where you have, like, 300 students where you just cannot talk to the prof. Like, your prof is basically the TA, so, like, yeah. Pay them what they're worth.
The TAs, for their part, say they're grateful for student support, especially since the improvements to their working conditions may help students as well. One of the main things they're asking for, remember, is TA hours fixed to the number of students in a class to ensure that they have more time to do adequate grading. And they say if students agree, they can reach out to McGill administration to make their voices heard.
Show up to the picket line. Almost every day of the week, we're going to be at Roddick Gates. And whenever you see us, you know, give us a thumbs up. Join if you have some time. I promise it's super fun. But the other really big things that you can do are emailing your professors, the chairs of your departments, deans of your faculties, and the president of the university to say, the TA demands are reasonable. I appreciate them. I want them back, and it's your responsibility to end this strike by giving them the deal they deserve.
I'm Jules Bijal. Thanks for listening. All right, you're back, and this is Jules. It's almost the end of our half-hour show today. Just an update on that story, which aired the week of March 25th. So when you hear them saying Monday was the first day of strike, that is the 25th of March, and the strike's been ongoing since then. So since that story initially aired, McGill's proposed a salary increase of 14.5% over 4 years, which is a major jump from the 5.25% over 5 years that the university initially put on the table. At the time of this story that you just heard, the offer was 10.5% over 4 years. So during the last few weeks of strikes, there's been an increase of around 4%. But McGill isn't budging on other matters, including their position that teaching assistants can't do other jobs on campus. So if you're a TA, you can't work as a research assistant during the strike, and you can't use your work email either. Last week, on April 4th, Quebec's labor tribunal, the Tribunal Administratif du Travail, rejected the TA union's demand for a safeguard order. This would have been an emergency order to prevent McGill from using profs, course lecturers, or other university employees as scabs to fill in for striking TAs. The TAs are still attempting to obtain an injunction later this spring. The next day, April 5th, McGill Director of Labor and Employee Relations Francis Desjardins released a public communication on a number of points about the TA strike. Desjardins argued that McGill TAs are the highest paid in the province already, and if they end up working more hours than their contract, there's a process they can follow to be paid. Though the union says that in practice, such requests are routinely denied. Picketing has also been a point of contention on campus. Desjardins writes that while peaceful picketing is lawful, obstructing academic activities, intimidating students and instructors, and damaging property is not. A number of colleagues and students have been unnerved by the interruptions within their classes and labs by AgSem members. Others said they felt too intimidated to enter buildings where members were blocking access. This is simply unacceptable, end quote. He reiterated that McGill will call police on picketers when laws or campus policies are breached, as the university has done in the past, which students and profs alike have said creates its own culture of fear during the strikes. And that's all for our show today. Thanks again for tuning in. Coming up next is Democracy Now! In just a few seconds. Take care.
This is Kristen Carter. My debut contemporary pop album, Full Bloom, is now yours to discover. Full Bloom is a living garden of 12 songs that celebrates the beauty and the seasonal nature of life. You can find Full Bloom wherever you listen to music. Visit thekristencarter.com or follow at Kristen Carter Music for more. Funded by Factor and Canada's private radio broadcasters.
This is Democracy Now!
The sad reality of what's happening in Gaza right now actually eclipses, I would argue, any sort of even comparative humanitarian crisis that we've seen.
Rwanda marks the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor.
It's not easy for people going through genocide to be that strong, but we're doing our best to make sure that the past never repeats itself.
As up to 1 million Rwandans were killed, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refusing to stop the slaughter. We'll speak with former Human Rights Watch Executive Director Ken Roth about the role of Western nations in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide and their role in Israel's assault on Gaza, which the UN's top court says is a plausible case of genocide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian media say airstrikes hit two homes in Gaza City's Zaytun neighborhood earlier today, killing and injuring dozens of people. Other attacks were reported in other Gaza City neighborhoods, including Shijaya and Sabra. This comes as negotiations in Egypt continue. Hamas says the latest ceasefire proposal does not meet its demands, but that it's continuing to review the plan, which includes a six-week pause in fighting and the exchange of 40 Israeli hostages for at least 700 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. While Hamas is demanding Israel end its assault on Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Monday that Israel has set a date to invade Rafah.
Today, I received a report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals. First and foremost, the release of all of our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. The victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Displaced Palestinians have been returning to Khan Yunis after Israel withdrew from the decimated southern city. One woman, Ayed al-Najjar, said normally she would be preparing for Eid celebrations at this time of year as she took in the ruins of her home.
Our house was good and had everything. I lacked nothing. I lived happily with my husband, and our daughter's children used to live with us too. There's no Eid for me. I have no desire to celebrate or do anything. I'll just sit in front of my house like this. We won't go anywhere. And many of our family members were martyred. They're still uncovering the bodies. Praise God. Who wants to celebrate? Every house has wounded or martyrs.
The UN Security Council will make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. Palestine initially submitted its application for UN admission in 2011. This is the Palestinian UN ambassador, Riyad Mansour, speaking Monday.
It was a historic moment then, and now that historic moment has been revived again, and we sincerely hope after 12 years since we changed our status to an observer state, that the Security Council will elevate itself to implementing the global consensus on the two-state solution by admitting the State of Palestine for full membership.
But the U.S., one of five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, is expected to use its veto power. U.S. representatives say Palestine needs to negotiate statehood with Israel before it's granted statehood at the U.N. Meanwhile, in The Hague, the International Court of Justice is holding its second day of hearings into Nicaragua's case against Germany. Germany's denied Nicaragua's charge that it violated the Genocide Convention by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Here in the U.S., Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. Warren made the remark as she visited a mosque and was asked by constituents if she believed Israel is committing genocide. Warren said, quote, "If you want to do it as an application of law, I believe that they'll find that it is genocide, and they have ample evidence to do so," she said. Ireland's incoming Prime Minister, Simon Harris, has called for an immediate ceasefire, saying in a speech Sunday the famine in Gaza is a, quote, specter no Irish person can bear, referencing Ireland's historical famines, including the Great Famine of the mid-19th century. Harris, who's being sworn in by Ireland's parliament today, had a message for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, let me say this to you this evening. The Irish people could not be clearer. We are repulsed by your actions. Cease fire now and let the aid flow safely.
Iran's foreign minister opened a new diplomatic site in the Syrian capital, Damascus, Monday, 1 week after Israel bombed the Iranian consulate, killing at least seven Iranian officers. Hossein Amirab Gulahian renewed Iran's vow to retaliate and accused the U.S. of giving Israel the green light for the attack.
I want to say from here in Damascus with a loud voice, America is responsible for this terrorist attack, and it must take responsibility.
Meanwhile, Iranian press is reporting Tehran told the Biden administration it'll refrain from attacking Israel if the U.S. can secure a ceasefire in Gaza. The report has not been confirmed by Tehran, and Biden administration has denied it. The University of Michigan's come under fire over its proposed disruptive activity policy, which was issued by the university president, Santa Ono, after Palestinian rights activists interrupted a speech he was giving. The ACLU of Michigan warns the policy will have a chilling effect and likely lead to violations of the First Amendment. Elsewhere, Vanderbilt University in Tennessee has expelled, suspended, and issued disciplinary probations to a group of students who engaged in a sit-in protest demanding Vanderbilt divest from companies complicit in Israel's occupation and killing of Palestinians. Special Counsel Jack Smith is urging the Supreme Court to dismiss Donald Trump's bid for immunity in his federal election interference case, arguing presidents are subject to criminal law. Supreme Court justices are scheduled to hear arguments in the case April 25th. In other Trump news, the GOP frontrunner said Monday abortion rights should be decided by states. Trump has refrained from endorsing a national abortion ban, but has taken credit for the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, which has led to a cascade of abortion bans in Republican-run states, including Florida, where a six-week ban is set to go into effect May 1st. The trial for 27 people charged in connection with the Panama Papers scandal began Monday in Panama City, 8 years after the massive data leak. In 2016, an international team of journalists published millions of documents exposing how the Panama-based Mossack Fonseca law firm set up a global network of shell companies for some of the wealthiest people in the world, heads of state and other elites, to hide money offshore, avoiding taxes and oversight. The leak prompted the resignation of Iceland's prime minister and implicated other world leaders, including former British Prime Minister David Cameron and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Those currently on trial include the founders of the now-defunct Mossack Fonseca law firm. The Panama Papers represent just a fraction of the trillions of dollars hidden away, often illegally, in offshore tax havens. About 100 people were killed, including children, after an overcrowded makeshift ferry sank off the northern coast of Mozambique. Some 20 others are missing. The group of 130 people had fled from Nampula on mainland Mozambique, reportedly after hearing news of a cholera outbreak. Mozambican authorities blamed their deaths on the spread of misinformation about the spread of the disease. President Biden announced new plans to cancel student debt for about 23 million people. Some of those to benefit include borrowers who now owe more than their original loan amount due to out-of-control interest. Those who have had debts for over 20 years, borrowers who were enrolled in so-called low-value school programs, and those facing economic hardship. The new plan would completely erase student debt for around 4 million borrowers. Biden announced the debt relief in a speech in Madison, Wisconsin, Monday, as he made another pitch for re-election in the key swing state.
I also want to make—and I've been pushing this, and if I'm re-elected, I'm going to push it hard. We're going to get it done next time—is I want to make community college tuition free. So you won't need loans at all. We're cutting half the cost of going to college.
In Strasbourg, France, the European Court of Human Rights handed out one victory and two defeats for the climate justice movement today as it ruled on three historic climate cases. The court ruled in favor of over 2,000 senior women from Switzerland who argued their rights were violated by governmental inaction on the climate crisis.
The court finds that there were some critical lacunae in the Swiss authorities' process of putting in place the relevant domestic regulatory framework. This included a failure to quantify, through a carbon budget or otherwise, national greenhouse gas emissions limitations. Furthermore, as recognized by the relevant authorities, the respondent state had previously failed to meet its past greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. By failing to act in good time and in an appropriate and consistent manner,
the Swiss women hailed their historic victory, but the celebration was tempered by the court's dismissal of similar cases by six youth activists in Portugal and a former French mayor. Activist Greta Thunberg, who was at the courthouse for the verdicts, weighed in on those verdicts.
It's a betrayal beyond words, and today's rulings make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens. It cannot be a political choice whether to respect human rights or not.
And the Brazilian state issued a historic apology for the atrocities committed against indigenous peoples during its military dictatorship. The unprecedented move came as Brazil marked last week the 60th anniversary of the 1964 U.S.-backed coup that ushered in the military dictatorship, which ruled for the next two decades. Brazil's National Truth Commission found 8,300 indigenous people were killed during the dictatorship. Others were thrown off their land, imprisoned in internment camps, and tortured. The apology came after the Guarani, Kiowa, and the Krenak indigenous groups requested a collective apology from the Brazilian government's Amnesty Commission. During a ceremony last Tuesday, the commission's chairwoman, Inea Destutz, kneeled in front of indigenous leaders to ask for their forgiveness. Here she addresses Janita Krenak.
I'm asking for forgiveness for the persecution that in the last 524 years, your people, as well as all the other original peoples, suffered due to the invasion that the non-indigenous people on this land that belongs to you. So you as leader, as the matriarch of the Krenak people, please bear our respect, our tributes, and our sincere apologies so that this never happens again.
Also last week on Friday, prominent journalist, author, and environmentalist Alton Krenak became the first indigenous member of the prestigious Brazilian Academy of Letters. Krenak vowed to use his seat to open the elite academy to the more than 200 indigenous languages in Brazil. He also reflected on the government's apology issued days earlier, saying, quote, "Saying sorry afterwards means very little in terms of reparation. What we need is real reparations for Native peoples," he said. Dreams Are Made of This by Eurythmics. Singer Annie Lennox has donated the 1983 handwritten lyrics to be auctioned off to benefit the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Rwanda is holding a week of commemorations marking the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide, when up to a million Tutsis and moderate Hutus were killed by Hutu militias. During the genocide, at least 250,000 women were raped. As the world watched the horror unfold 30 years ago, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refused to help stop the killing. The Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, said in a speech Sunday, the international community, quote, failed all of us. Former U.S. President Bill Clinton traveled to Rwanda this week to mark the 30th anniversary of the genocide, along with other foreign dignitaries. As President Clinton refused to label the 1994 mass killings in Rwanda's genocide, he has since said his failure to respond was one of his biggest regrets of his presidency. This is President Clinton speaking in 1998.
We did not immediately call these crimes by their rightful name, genocide. We cannot change the past, but we can and must do everything in our power to help you build a future without fear.
In 2021, French President Emmanuel Macron acknowledged France's role in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide. The anniversary of the genocide comes at a time when Rwanda's longtime president, Paul Kagame, is coming under increasing criticism for his autocratic rule. To talk more about Rwanda 30 years after the genocide, we're joined by two guests. Still with us, Ken Roth served for nearly three decades as the executive director of Human Rights Watch, now visiting professor at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs. And joining us from Sydney, Australia, is Noel Zehabamwe, the founder and chairperson of the African Australian Advocacy Center. Both his parents were killed during the genocide. He's co-author of the book 1,000 Hills. Noel, thank you so much for being with us. Talk about what happened 30 years ago and ultimately why you had to leave Rwanda many years later. What happened to your parents?
First and foremost, let me start by thanking you for hosting me, Emery. 30 years ago, my country of birth descended into darkness and the pain of genocide. And I remember very well when I was with my parents and my younger sister, and I recall my daddy telling me that we see each other in heaven. That's the last word I had from my father, and since then, we never met again. That's what happened 30 years ago in April, when this darkness descended into a wonderful country, which is 1,000 hills. And as I can say, I tragically not only lost my parents, I also lost immediate and extended family members.
And can you talk about the role of the genocide in shaping how the international community looked at President Kagame's leadership? He was portrayed as a hero who ended the genocide.
It's very important to understand that everyone should see that the genocide was coming. And I agree with you saying that the international community has failed to save or to help Rwanda from descending into that tragedy. However, in 1994, I remember very well that there was a way that the international community was going to stop the genocide, but they ended up not doing so. Like many victims, many Tutsis were being targeted, killed, and also, of course, as we said, many Hutus as well, and also Twa and the foreigners. There's no doubt that all those victims were being killed, and international community was standing by. So, however, when genocide ended in July, we all hoped that the country was going to be rebuilding itself. And also, many people, especially survivors, we thought that Rwanda was going to be, again, a Rwanda we used to know when we were kids, like a Rwanda of 1,000 hills. However, we started noticing that what we thought was going to be a country of peace, a country of harmony, we could see that there was a from the current Ruhengi regime, there was the other atrocities committed, actually, targeting also the Hutus as well. So from April to July, Tutsis were mainly targeted, killed because they were Tutsis. And also when the government took over the current regime, we thought that storm was over, but we could see also there was other atrocities from RPF side. So what happened now? As I was a child, I remember I fled to Burundi, and then I came back in September. I went to orphanage center. That's where I spent my teenagerhood. When I finished high school, I went to university. When I started university, I started being approached, being coerced to join the current regime, which I refused because I didn't want to join politics because one of the main problems Rwanda has always have is poor leadership. The leaders Rwanda has ever had, they don't look into big picture. They always look into narrowing to those kind of I can say their own interest rather than looking into public, general interest. So then when I was the first many times to join a Ruhengi party, I was told that even though when you finish university, you may not get a job, you may even not get there. And then I continue, being chased away. And then I end up becoming again a refugee. Then I went to Kenya. I came to Australia. Coming to Australia, I started building my life from scratch. And then when I had my family, I became a community leader here. After becoming a community leader, I was approached by ambassador who was based in Singapore to work for them again. And then which I refused because I said I can't do that kind of a job. And then the price I was given, my two brothers, 5 years ago, on the 28th of September, were during the day removed from the bus. Since then, they have never been found again, despite having credible evidences with the driver who was driving the bus and the passengers who have seen my brothers being removed from the bus. When I started claiming, asking for the government for help, the government refused to help me. Instead, they started tarnishing my image in the media that I'm lying, that I'm in opposition. So that's a kind of image many victims like me have. So being a victim of a genocide, once again, so being a victim of the regime that came to power, promising us to live in harmony and peace.
Noel, I wanted to talk about what's happening today with Paul Kagame's Rwanda, but I want to stay in 1994 for a moment, when the United States government carefully avoided using the word genocide to describe what was happening in Rwanda. This is a clip from PBS Frontline documentary Ghosts of Rwanda, beginning with a State Department briefing, April 28, 1994.
Comment on that, or a view as to whether or not what is happening could be genocide.
Well, as I think you know, the use of the term genocide has a very precise legal meaning, although it's not strictly a legal determination. There are other factors in there as well. When in looking at a situation to make a determination about that, before we begin to use that term, we have to know as much as possible about the facts of the situation.
Out of curiosity, given that so many people say that there is genocide underway or something that strongly resembles it, why wouldn't this convention be involved?
Well, I think, as you know, this becomes a legal definitional thing, unfortunately, in terms of as horrendous as all these things are, there becomes a definitional question.
That was Madeleine Albright speaking in 1994. Ken Roth, you were Human Rights Watch executive director at the time. We don't have much time, but explain what the U.S. didn't do.
Well, first of all, these word games with genocide were because there was a perceived obligation that if there is genocide, you have to suppress it. You have to act. And so they said, oh, it's maybe acts of genocide, which they thought meant something lesser. Now, this was a moment, it's hard to think back, but this was before Bush's invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. It was an era where Americans were very unused to the idea of American military casualties abroad. And Clinton was just not going to risk it further after the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia. So he was determined not to send in troops. It's important to recognize that the Rwandan genocide was carried out by a rudimentary force, basically using hate radio, the infamous Radio Milkolin, to rally people with machetes to kill their neighbors. And Alison DeForge, my colleague at the time, who was really one of the world's experts on Rwanda, was convinced that two forces could have stopped the genocide: the UN peacekeepers, UNAMIR, and a French evacuation force that was sent in. But the French evacuation force evacuated the Westerners and left Rwandans to their fate. The UN Security Council, at U.S. urging, reduced the number of peacekeepers from 2,500 to 250 and never gave them a protective mandate. And so as a result, the genocide unfolded. And when Clinton, you know, apologizes today, it's because he did nothing to stop the genocide. Indeed, I remember we were meeting with Anthony Lake, the national security advisor of Clinton at the time, and he said, make more noise. In other words, we're not going to stop the genocide as a legal duty. We're not going to stop the genocide because we have a moral responsibility to do that. We're only going to stop it if there's no political cost, if the American people are demanding this of us. That was the complete abdication of moral responsibility of the Clinton administration.
And Ken, we only have about a minute left, but what parallels do you see with how the U.S. Acted or didn't act back then to the war we're facing right now with on the part of Israel and Gaza?
Well, one, interestingly, it would be easier for the U.S. to act today. In other words, in the case of Rwanda, it would have meant sending in troops. Nobody's going to send in troops to Gaza, but what the U.S. could do, as we were discussing, they could stop arming. They could stop funding the plausible genocide, the clear war crimes in Gaza. And so it's just a matter of saying the money and the arms will stop unless the killing and the starvation stops. That's all it would take, and Netanyahu would have to listen. Biden refuses to take that step.
And what do you think he could do at this point to turn this around?
It's as simple as that, Amy. In other words, if he were to say, you know, Netanyahu, I've had it with your game playing. I've had it with your pretending to comply with my concerns. This is it. You know, you've got to really stop bombing civilians. You've got to open up the gates and allow food in. And if that doesn't start today, the arms sales end tomorrow.
This is Afua Cooper, and you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
All right. Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show.
You are listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT. My name is Candace, and I'm your host for today's show. Today's episode features a panel discussion from the Asian Prisoner Support Committee and 18 Million Rising about their present campaign to demand a pardon for the APSC-4. We will hear